Hey, folks, and welcome to the Daily Ratings Podcast. It's a show where each week we're going to be sitting down with Vincent Daly to get his thoughts on the latest movies he's been watching, both older films and new releases. And don't worry, there's no spoilers. Vince will give a brief review of the movie, share some thoughts, and of course, then rate the film. The Daily Ratings are always fair, honest, and most importantly, they're consistent. On today's show, Vince will be rating and reviewing. We have Dune from 1984, directed by David Lynch. We have Jodorowsky's Dune, directed by Frank Pavich. We have 2021's Dune by Denis Villeneuve. And finally, of course, newly released Dune Part 2, directed by Denis Villeneuve. So it is going to be, it's Dune week here, folks, on the Daily Ratings. So stay tuned and enjoy. Vincent Daly, how we doing?
Thomas Recker. Very important week here.
Big week.
I have never been so excited to record.
I'm pretty pumped too.
Yeah. Man. I mean, let me not, for folks at home, break the magic too much, but this is a job when we comes to reviewing movies. Like, even really good weeks, like Barbenheimer, or when we covered Scorsese's film. It's very much a job, you know, trying to put my thoughts together on things. Yeah. This one came so naturally. We could not record soon enough, honestly.
You're chomping at the bit.
Oh, yeah.
Me too. I mean, I what's funny is I was having difficulty getting all my thoughts together.
Oh, sure. Sure.
And finally, just sitting down and just having to put pen to paper.
Right. You had some spice, and then you were able to see.
Is it melange too?
Oh, melange?
Melange?
Yeah, okay. It's the spice melange. I guess melange is not a slang, but a term for just like a drug.
Yeah. I just didn't know how to pronounce it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then I started writing and realizing that it's like, oh, I'm writing too much. It's so it was all just flowing out on the page.
Yeah, right.
In a great way. But you're right. Not that, you know, when we see Oppenheimer or a Scorsese flick.
Yep.
You know, like
Killers
you said,
of the Flower Moon. Like,
it is work. It's enjoyable.
Yeah.
But it's like, wow, okay, let's make sure we're really...
Right. Ticking all the boxes, making sure that the review makes sense, that it hits a certain function, that it's actually about recommending the film and not spoiling the film.
Right, and making a good product.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Vomitous of the mouth.
Exactly. Here, though, man, I was just like so excited to talk about this. And
it was
fun. We just haven't had a sci-fi film like this to talk about. So.
That, and I think we're finally... I don't know, you know, we're on, this is like an episode 124, which is great. So we've been doing it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
This is our full second year that we're doing it.
Yep.
And this is the first big film of 2024. Like, things are popping off after this.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, it's January and February are called Dumpuary. Like, that is the industry name for these 2 months.
Yeah, for
and
real.
So here we are in, like, March 1st, and we have just a kick-ass movie come out.
Yes, absolutely.
Super exciting.
Yeah.
Super exciting. And a great watch. I cannot wait to get into that. And I like how you structured the week where it's like, you know what? We're just going to do Dune.
Yeah, we're just going to do Dune.
Because at first we were throwing around, well, we'll do other sci-fi. We'll do.
Yep.
And then when you text me, you're just like, you know what? We're just going to do Dune.
Yeah. In a lot of ways, I just did not want to consume any other world building.
Because right there.
Dune is also so dense as well. And in the time between when we reviewed the 2021 film, where I said kind of I had almost like zero awareness or appreciation of the world building.
Yeah.
In the years since, I've kind of, you know, again, the ANK, the approximate nerd knowledge, has grown to really appreciate what Dune is about and the original books.
I'm right there too. And I would like to say in between that last film and now, but it's really the past week. It's been my masterclass on Dune.
The faucet.
It's been awesome, though. It's been so, so great. Quite the Dune week. We're going to have to really snap ourselves out of it. Get ready for Kung Fu Panda.
Yeah, Kung Fu Panda.
Oh, I
want to
start
week.
With that, too. I messed up last week because we have a special coming out and a new special that we've never had before, which is a deep dive, a deep dive into a must-watch film on the Daily Ratings.
Uh-huh.
So I was said it was going to be next week. It is 2 weeks from now.
Yeah.
I forgot about Kung Fu Panda. We're going to have a very Kung Fu Panda week next week. But 2 weeks from now, folks, I just want to remind everybody.
Sandwiched in between is Jack Black eating bao buns or whatever he eats with dumplings.
2 weeks from now, though, folks, we are doing the special on No Country for Old Men, full episode on just one film. There will be spoilers, but we have different categories, and we were just going through this much-watch film.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the 90 percentiles on the daily ratings. Out of the 1,000 films on the site, we have 1,200 films based on the master list that I'm kind of working onto the site slowly but surely. There's like 11, 10, or, I don't know, 12, less than 15 films in the 90s.
Right.
So we're taking a special look at No Country for Old Men. We cannot wait. It's very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
But in 2 weeks, next week, don't worry, stay tuned because it will be a Kung Fu Panda. But anyway, I love, like I said, we structured this week. You and I had originally watched David Lynch's Dune years ago. It was during the couch days,
right,
where we were in the mode of sitting down every few months and to get a rating from you.
Yeah, getting scores and watching movie with the intention to kind of, you know, critically analyze it. So.
Always with the hope of having a podcast and website, but way off.
Not knowing what it was gonna feel like.
So I'll just briefly touch on original thoughts when we sat down and watched this. We're not fans of the film.
No.
Confused as hell.
No,
And knew that it was kind of not great. We knew that David Lynch doesn't like it. David Lynch does. I was just watching another interview with him saying, like, he never got the final cut. Biggest lesson in directing. Don't ever let that happen. They ruined the whole thing. And from the get-go, you don't care.
Ooh,
it was terrible.
Yeah.
Yada, yada.
Yeah, Lynch is very outspoken about this production because I think it's his third film coming in. And, I mean, he's just such a unique guy to begin with. I feel like the corporate studio structures around him that were trying to push this movie.
Yeah, it caused problems.
Yeah, yeah.
But those were the initial reactions way, way back when. But folks, we're going to jump back to... I'm sorry, any more opening notes?
No. Yeah, we're golden.
All right, we're jumping back to 1984. This is Dune by David Lynch. This is the first successful adaptation that was brought to screen.
Mm.
Of course,
successful.
Successfully.
Right. That's in quotes for sure.
But let's jump back. I mean, you know, it was made 40 years ago.
Yeah, that was crazy.
And Dune, the original book, came out in 65, so it's basically 20 years after the first book came out.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Herbert, the author of Dune, ended up making 5 more books, 6 total, and all of them sequels.
Mm-hmm. And then I think a year after, in 85, he unfortunately dies, mm-hmm. and then that's where his son takes over the reins, and that's
which is
where we get kind of the expanded... if you will, paperback versions of the Dune universe.
Yeah,
so there's a lot more quantity over quality, but it's still very much beloved by the fan base.
Yes, and jumps in timeline then. It's not like you're just sticking to like, oh, this book ended, next book picks up, this book ended. It's really all over the place. But and just a fair warning, I'm going to probably be definitely... certainly bringing up Lord of the Rings at some point.
Rightfully so.
Okay.
I feel like Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, all within the wheelhouse of comparison here as like epics or sagas.
Yeah, just flagpoles. Something
sure.
we can point to and people know what we're talking about
absolutely.
A little bit.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, anyway. 1984, David Lynch's Dune. Vin, let's get into it. And how was watching it again? How'd you like it?
Enlightening, I will say that. Really enlightening. Folks, an early director's study I dropped was for none other than David Lynch, the best hair among any director, I would say.
Wow.
He definitely wins that. However, after watching Eraserhead for a very early episode of the podcast and knowing what this shit show was, I happily never looked back. you know, as far as Lynch goes, he is kind of in a... You know, I don't know, an evergreen appreciation online. I certainly have a lot of respect for Twin Peaks, but his stuff just does not click for me all the time. And additionally, this film was a nightmare production for Lynch, who's far from his surreal wheelhouse. Again, like we commented on in this kind of big studio production, just a very poor match with the talents and the vision of an oddball director. In one movie, shorter than either of Denny's movies, it attempts to cover a large portion of the story, including the fall of House Atreides and the rise of Paul as a figure of immense power on the planet Arrakis. It also attempts to show us the breadcrumbs of the larger galactic story, including the Spacing Guild, with one of the most disgusting prosthetic aliens ever put on screen. The leader of the Spacing Guild is this, like, pustule fetus floating in the air that controls how the spice is used for space travel. It's disgusting. I mean, I seriously, if you have tracheophobia or that fear of, like, multiple holes, this is a no-go. This is a no-go. It's really a disturbing addition among many of Lynch's style into this sci-fi. But generally, this rendition of Dune bites off much more than it can chew, and has left any viewer of this in the last 40 years in a tizzy. Worse yet, watching in modern day compared to the new ones is still... It's still hard to wrap your head around the story. I know what the story is right now, and I'm still struggling when it comes to that. And I feel like it really is illustrative of how monumental and how unwieldy the Dune story is. And we'll obviously get into that in Jodorowsky's Dune, of how it kind of is a story of visionary directors failing to adapt this colossal work. I would say it is honestly staggering how poorly concepts are communicated in this fucking movie. I think one of the more subtle ones is spotting how Paul's psychic abilities are on screen and how it's signified to the viewer. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just so increasingly unclear what is internal monologue versus visions versus others' thoughts that don't have psychic abilities versus who is meant to hear what. It is dizzying. Like, it's like,
I barely remember the film.
Oh, yeah. It's like, who's talking and who's meant to hear this? It's absolutely ridiculous. And simple missteps like this throughout the film almost gives us what I would call, especially on this rewatch, negative world building. You know, where the more things put on screen, mind-blowingly, the more concepts that are thrown in front of us, the weaker our understanding of Dune's mythology and Dune's world building becomes. The weirdness is without context, without association, and... It really, again, the term that I kind of thought of when watching this is it's almost like a negative world building. It kind of reduces our understanding the more things thrown in front of us. Does that make sense?
The more there is, there's less to hold on to.
Yes, because you're...
And so you just...
You're further wondering, what the hell is this now?
Right. Right. You're a race car driver trying to look at the fans. They're just going by way too fast.
Beautiful.
You can't get the faces to any of them.
Absolutely.
They're here and they're gone.
But the further you focus, it's like, oh no, I have no understanding of this. No less, folks, this features a very heavy narration telling us exactly what the story is about. So, again, it leans on to the quality and the burden of how this is trying to adapt so much of a story, even just beyond Herbert's first novel. It really is trying to plant the seeds of where the story goes, which is great, but a difficult balancing act. I would say for a week that has been a feast for the eyes when it comes to sci-fi design, this just plain pisses me off. Honestly, this has just got terrible sci-fi design. I'm not kidding. I think every single set sucks in this. From each of the house architecture to the space tech, it's really just like all ass. House Atreides looks like a space pirate ship vibe with everything having like a leather backing, kind of like a bar stool or something like that. It's ridiculous. House Harkonnen looks straight out of like a Joel Schumacher Batman film, like straight up Riddler's lair at the end of Batman Forever. It's just like metalwork and rebarb and then green lights. It's just like, it's so bad, so bad. And then the Fremen are just Soviet Russia. It's just like...
The Fremen are.
Yeah, it's just the depths of oh yeah, they're different. You know, it's a rebellion. It's terrible, terrible. really, where 1984 goes to die as far as sci-fi design is this movie.
You feel bad for the film. You feel bad for David Lynch because it is a huge undertaking.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
It is like trying to take up Lord of the Rings and make it into film.
Sure.
But at the same time, it's don't even try it unless you have a ridiculously sized budget and the means to do it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like the team, everybody involved. Mm. Mm. Because it's so easy to fail.
So easy.
And this one does fail.
Yeah, absolutely. When it comes to also that very unique tech of the world of Dune, it looks like Lynch is trying just every contrary decision possible. Once again, the more concepts that are thrown at the viewer, the more vague the world building becomes. You might think that the secret to a bold new sci-fi vision is just throwing things that we're not familiar with on screen, but in fact it's the opposite. You still have to associate your design and your imagery with the normal. A great example of this with the Villeneuve rendition is filming the ornithopters like it's a Vietnam chopper scene. Alien vehicle presented as familiar.
Mm, yeah.
Another great example is the thumper device. Here it's like this ritualistic pole. I get where the team with Lynch would see that as it relates to the Fremen people, as it relates to the worms. But in the new one, it's clearly just a tool of war and probably closer to an egg timer than anything.
Right, nice, yeah.
You know what I mean? That's good sci-fi design. And even though the world is bold and the vision is you know, out there, you still have to associate with what we're used to, the normality of it.
Right.
And what we're
I love that.
With.
We have to be grounded somehow.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Folks, like we said, this was previously rated as, you know, with both Tom and I, curious of the hype, even though that there really wasn't hype. We just kind of knew the name and jumped into it.
Yes, there is a weird cult following.
Yeah.
And I think also because it was the only thing that true fans of the book have. And there's a huge, I mean, it's such a good, well-selling book.
Yep.
There is a huge fan base for it. Mm-hmm. And this is all they had. I mean, there was a very small TV show in the early 2000s as well.
Yep, yep.
But
I think it's with James McAvoy, actually.
And, oh, okay, all right.
But not adapting this first book. I think it's
that's
the
correct.
Further books.
That is correct, it is, yeah.
So they you're absolutely right. These fans just had this terrible movie.
But it's so well known how bad it is.
Yeah.
Still, yeah.
And let me tell you, I was right on the money with this original score. I pulled some voodoo Bene Gesserit magic, and I saw a vision of how poorly this one would hold up next to the new one. I would say it's easy to jab at this one. I think it's important to consider the production a tiny bit, and especially saving David Lynch's reputation, whether you're a fan or whether you're just kind of aware of him. But, you know, whether it's this movie being made in 1984 or not enough money or anything like that, I need to stress it all is in the impossibly poor execution. And as we have in the past, we are going to go ahead and give Dune 1984 a 20 on the dot.
I love it.
Yeah.
20% not changed. We're still consistent here.
Yeah, still consistent. I can't tell you how much I really agree with that. I would
I love
seriously
it.
Give it a try.
I absolutely love it.
Yeah.
Anything to say on performances? Like Sting is in it. Kyle MacLachlan or whatever his name is.
Oh, sure. And that's where I believe Lynch and him meet for Twin Peaks then.
Right.
Which really defines MacLachlan's career. I don't know. No, I don't think so. I would say it's very funny to see Patrick Stewart go from like this military man.
That's right, yeah.
And then he rushes into battle. Oh, he plays Gurney.
Yeah.
He rushes into battle holding a pug. Like a dog.
Which I don't remember any of this.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I say
it was so.
I feel like this needed a rewatch.
Time. It was
more than Dune 2021.
So true.
Yeah. Also, I have one note that I had nowhere to put in the review.
Go ahead.
But in the 1984 film, we get the famous line: "A walk without rhythm won't attract the worm." This is, of course, then featured in the Fat Boy Slim song "Weapon of Choice," which the music video is Christopher Walken dancing, and really an all-time great music video.
Oh, that's an epic video, yeah.
And now epic. Christopher Walken is the Emperor of the Galaxy in the new one.
I love the connective tissue, the cartilage that holds this podcast together every week.
Right, right.
Wherever we can find it. Love that. That video is so classic.
Excellent. Excellent music.
Okay, 20% for Dude, 1984. Again, it's already on the site for all you who are in tune a little bit. Let's jump to 2013. This is going to be the one that I don't think a lot of people know what this is. It surprised me. Didn't know anything about that this documentary existed and let alone what it was about.
You know
what I mean? Or the story behind it. So this is director Frank Pavich.
I didn't do much research on the documentary side of that.
So. This is a straight documentary called Jodorowsky's Dune. Jodorowsky's Dune, something like that.
You got it.
Came out 10 years ago. It came out in Cannes Film Festival in 2013. Won some awards as well, and then had a small theater release. Let's get into what this documentary is, the story it tells, and how'd you like it?
Yeah. Well, I actually really liked this documentary, both for the subject matter, but also the execution of things, you know, how the information is presented. Folks, this is a documentary showing one of the many failed attempts to adapt Frank Herbert's sci-fi masterpiece, Dune, a book series that spans across tens of thousands of years and has equally stumped and intimidated Hollywood for decades. This spotlights an interesting production story over the years, showing how visionary directors tried to tackle Dune with vastly different outcomes due to its literary experience. Anyone that has read Dune will tell you that it's kind of a messy book, but one that creates an experience to the medium of it being a novel. It's not something that was thought to be able to be adapted, you know, in a lot of ways. So I think this is a interesting story because it shines a spotlight on what many directors have tried, stumbled, and failed completely at trying to do. But this attempt proved to be beyond the realm of science fiction itself. And it is at the hands of one of the wildest directors out there. Alejandro Jodorowsky is a bona fide madman. And this attempt was only 2 years after the only film that I and we have seen, 1973's The Holy Mountain.
Oh, he does a Holy Mountain?
I was hoping you didn't do much research into this one.
I did.
Because I wanted that reveal. Because you know, we've shared that experience.
Folks, The Holy Mountain is known. I mean, talk about a cult following as well.
Oh, yes.
Some people love it. But
art house, weird.
This film in the 70s is uber crazy, uber weird. It goes to places and makes you see things that, is this the biggest waste of time? Is this just... just an art genius we're watching.
Sure.
In real time.
Yep.
It is a struggle to watch if you're not about it. We were not about it.
Yep.
Okay. Now we know who this guy is.
The madman. Unfortunately, The Holy Mountain is actually unrated on the website. That actually was probably something that we watched before we were really tracking everything. So I guess I'll say maybe fortunately. Because The Holy Mountain is a doozy. To quote our director's own words, though, he wanted this film to simulate taking LSD without taking the drug, and that he wanted the film itself to be a, I'm quoting him directly, a sacred cinematic god changing the minds of everyone that watched it. Tom's rubbing his eyes that the day is setting in hearing that.
Then go and make Dune. Like, honestly, then go ahead and try to make Dune. I guess you found your book.
Right.
As your crazy platform.
And I think that's, hearing him talk throughout this, he kind of sells you on that idea. Don't get me wrong, folks. This is a very artsy filmmaker, perhaps one of the artsiest, kind of just riffing and talking out of his ass, which I know is something that you don't like, Tom. You really hate that. But I will say he sells the idea, and why it's a good documentary is because you hear the passion that clearly got a team in the 70s to rally around this. You hear the passion of as he would pitch it in a room.
Right.
And for a story centered around a cosmic awakening drug called Spice, there are some interesting angles to trying to make a psychedelic experience out of this.
Well, I'll say Frank Herbert had like huge mushroom and LSD stuff like with the book.
Oh.
A lot of the ideas that he got for Spice came from mushrooms.
Sure.
Sandworms.
65. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Sandworms representing the worms that help decay mushrooms and fungi over time. I mean, like a lot sure. of LSD, and specifically mushrooms, were a huge, huge inspiration to Frank Herbert, and like making things for Dune. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And I mean, you know, Star Trek's out. How do you imagine some of the things? So.
But like the blue eyes, it's a certain type of blue mushroom that's used.
Really? Okay, yeah. Interesting.
Like
interesting.
Crazy callback. So
a little bit of a psychonaut.
Right. So this Jodorowsky's on the right track. Almost,
right. You know? And maybe the right talent, but also maybe not. As I will kind of comment in just a second, documentary reviews I really want to try to tackle this year, but it's a little intimidating because of how I want to break it down. I want to break down my reviews for documentaries a little bit more cold, a little bit more functional, and I feel like why this documentary is worth a watch is for a good handful of reasons. One, it's probably the best spotlight on Jodorowsky's career. Something that is very useful considering I would hardly recommend watching any of his films.
Right.
Actually, his first film that got him famous is a Western.
Really?
Mm. Okay. I'm down. Gut reaction against that. But.
No. We'll check it out.
Yeah. Second, it highlights how Dune is one of the greatest science fiction works of all time mm-hmm. and the impact it had on readers before any movie. When coming out in 65 and now in the 70s when a lot of this context is being put in. You know, it also scratches an itch in seeing different interpretations of a massive a novel series, similar to when we watched those Lord of the Rings animated films. I feel like there's an appreciation I had of like, oh, wow, this is a totally different take and still hitting on themes and things like that.
Right, you're still picking up on things.
Exactly.
It still works, unlike the 1984 Dune that fails so much.
Right.
But yeah, I
further confuses mm-hmm. those. You know, I'm itching all over now. But I feel like there was something to that for this documentary of, again, it's a lot of concept art and whatnot. It's not actual footage or anything. It scratched that similar itch as the animated Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Know? It was like, wow,
yeah.
This is someone else's take. So, and on that note of concept art, finally, it is the best thing to seeing this hypothetical 70s Dune with stunning concept art and interviews from legendary sci-fi designers like Mobius, Chris Foss, and H.R. Geiger himself, still alive in 2013 when this was made. Those that appreciate sci-fi like I do, sci-fi art, concept art, mm-hmm. storyboarding, this is invaluable. This is a huge eye-opener to what happens in the concept phase of big sci-fis that eventually have to be chopped down and chopped down to reach to cinemas, but the ideas put for pen to paper
right.
are huge here from some of the best concept artists ever.
That's cool. That's very cool.
Yeah.
Get at H.R. Geiger a little bit. Some works that he's done, or why is he as big?
Oh, H.R. Geiger, of course, developed the Xenomorph in the Alien franchise.
Oh, wow. Okay.
All of the mix of mechanical flesh and gothic aesthetic of that entire Alien franchise is all H.R. Geiger.
Oh, very cool. Okay.
Yeah. I always get confused if it's Geiger or Giger, so sorry if I'm making an ass of myself.
I'll make one more point, too. Because we are so documentary short on the daily ratings, you and I have talked about this multiple times over the past couple years of, you know, it could be a challenging thing to rate and review.
Yes.
Because it's so subjective. Do we care about the material that the documentary is about? Do we not?
Mm-hmm.
And format-wise, it can vary greatly, but also it's very simplistic. A documentary, you're talking about a single thing, and you're having experts or people involving around that thing talking about the thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's
that's where I wanted to kind of reduce it to, why is it worth a watch? And almost like kind of a bullet point structure of like, hey, what's the skin in the game on this?
And I think that's a great way to go about it. And I'm excited to hear you say you want to cover some more documentaries this year. And especially because, you know, this is 2013. This is just in the beginning of the documentary boom, I would say.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think once when Netflix really became a thing and then other streamers came up, it was a new home for documentaries.
Yes.
They're hard to make money in theater.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They're hard to... You can't have that many PBS documentaries. Or,
right.
You know what I
How
mean?
How do you even market to an audience, you know, when it's more topic-based or it's more informative-based?
BBC and Discovery Channel did a great job with all the David Attenborough stuff.
But
other than that, documentaries were just random specials on TV here or there.
Yeah.
But now with streamers and platforms, and you could have so many different subjects, I think there was a huge boon. And you think of like... Jiro Dreams of Sushi, and back in those, right around this
early Netflix hits.
Yes, I definitely think there's a boon, and now we have a great amount of content.
Yes,
Some notable ones we covered, though. We covered the Anthony Bourdain's one, and we did one on Sparks Brothers by Edgar Wright as well.
Oh, that's right. I totally forgot about Sparks Brothers.
Yeah.
Well,
Not many documentaries on the sites, but the ones you've covered, you've been quite a fan of.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I'll have to check back on Sparks Brothers because I want to kind of create a new rule with documentaries, but I'll get to that in just a second.
Anyway, yeah.
I thought it was only the Bourdain doc, but we'll get to that in a second.
Not to take us down a huge tangent, but I think that's a good note for us of where we are on documentaries.
Yes, yeah. Yes, absolutely. Like with all things, folks, this podcast, it's about discovering new movies, talking about movies, finding out how to talk about movies. When it comes to that kind of journey, I feel like documentaries are so big and something I genuinely enjoy as well. So
yeah.
I think that's a little bit of the challenge on the horizon. So
excellent.
Back to Jodorowsky's Dune, I think where this hit a magic spot for me, in addition to those three main points of, you know, why it's worth a watch, I think most of all, it poses an interesting question for sci-fi lovers. This was proposed to be made in 1975,
mm-hmm.
And that puts it after the pristine future shown in things like Star Trek and 2001 A Space Odyssey, but still long before Star Wars and Aliens, ushering in the used future aesthetic. If this movie was made, in no way do I think it would be financially successful.
Right.
So let's just say that. But would it change the stylings of sci-fi as a genre at a very important time, mainly pre-Star Wars, pre-New Hope? I would say the most convincing part about this whole film is, once again, the cutting-edge vision of Jodorowsky himself and what he wanted to accomplish. And hearing him talk is so enjoyable because he's clearly just like a very artsy man, you know? I feel like that is, at least for me, what was my personal skin in the game on this one. If you're a fan of concept art in any way, I think you will appreciate the context of what releasing this film could do to sway cinema history, or at least sci-fi as a genre. And I feel like that was my, you know, kind of personal investment in this. But like we were talking about just a second ago, Tom, mm-hmm. I think in line with other documentaries we reviewed, mainly the Bourdain doc, I think I want to make kind of a custom rule covering documentaries, since documentaries can kind of cover a wide range of purpose and audiences and information delivered. I want to simplify the scoring intervals to just 10, so 40, 50, 60, 70, yada, yada. I feel like I don't know, at least at this point, mm-hmm. I don't feel there's value in determining the minute movements in between those scores. I really want to simplify it down to, is it worth your time or is it it? So
okay,
and I found my time with this documentary well worth it. A visual feast at times, a bit of cinematic history for movie nerds, and most of all, just plenty of time with the madman himself that has a brain like no other and really creates a fun, well-paced documentary through this crazy, crazy, crazy idea. With that said, we're going to go ahead and give Jodorowsky's Dune 2013 a 70 on the dot.
Okay, 70 on the dot. And a good doc. I like it.
Yeah.
Interesting scoring system.
I feel
like as we go, mm-hmm. I just think you might curtail that as we go.
Okay.
And I think you might bring it back down to fives.
Yeah. That's a good point. That's a good point. And I totally forgot about the Sparks Brothers doc, so I forget what I gave that, honestly.
You liked it. I know that.
Yeah.
Because you paired it with Annette.
Oh, right.
Which that was
a doozy. Also, probably my worst review I ever wrote just because Annette, it was such a crazy movie, but mm-hmm. I didn't summarize it at all.
That's the early days of the podcast.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, I like that. I kind of like how you're approaching it.
Because
documentaries are different, and it's so, they're not this great cinematic. It's a movie, but it's different.
I also think it's important in the review of it to try to maybe have some thick skin and not be swayed by a medium that is so much around kind of sparking emotion and maybe even like a call to action in ways.
Yes, yes.
So that's really what intimidates me when in
like
reviewing
a Blackfish
this.
Or something.
Sure, right. Yeah, but something that we'll unpack and excited to unpack.
I love it. Yeah, I think it's exciting too. I was thinking about it the other day.
Mm.
It'd just be nice. There's so much out there.
Mm,
and music docs too and stuff like that. But anyway,
true.
Okay, all right, folks. So we are going to jump on episode 15, early episode, you know still getting our microphone feet still. But on episode 15, we were around when the first Dune Part 1 came out.
In the glory days of just the untouched HBO Max, just a beautiful streaming service. I mean, absolutely. HBO Max 2020,
it's good now.
No.
Max is good now.
I got to see all the Discovery crap on it now.
Bull Rush?
Yeah.
Not a fan? Whitewater's better than a normal Gold Rush now, by the
way. Really? That's the new king.
That's the hot take.
Right. Well, he's made it too much.
Okay, so basically, let's just... The reason why we're including it in this episode, folks, is we're not going to do another huge rundown for it.
No. And that opens a can of worms as far as previous reviews. I did the work. I want that to pay dividends. Yeah. You know, I'm not trying to just repeat my thoughts.
But it's important. We'll touch on it just a little bit. I'll say right off the bat. So I watched this just days before watching Doom Part 2.
Okay.
And I think you might have done the same thing.
I not really that it was a grand plan or scheme or anything. I watched it after seeing Part 2.
Okay.
And then before the rewatch of part, another watch of part two, I fit that in there.
I think it's important to freshen yourself up a little bit.
Yeah.
If you like the first one before you go into two, it's like, well, I pretty much remember it. I know we're good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can do a YouTube catch up and everything.
Sure.
Watch a 10-minute video. But it's good to go back and watch, I think, Dune Part 1, because this is encompassing one book. It really is two halves, basically.
Yes, yes.
So it's kind of nice to refreshen up, and that's why we're just going to take the time here. Any bullet points? Or
light bullet points. I would say, listening back to my old review, I can happily say that the sequel avoided what I was calling Deathly Hallows syndrome, where the second half would feel lopsided in action.
Right.
Dune Part 2 definitely does feel like a lot more of an action sci-fi epic than Part 1, but at the same time, it comes nowhere close to what I feared with what I called, again, Deathly Hallows syndrome, where the last Harry Potter is broken up lopsided.
Oh, yeah, what everybody's doing.
Yeah, exactly. And honestly, a concept that we have, since that review, covered with, like, the Hunger Games movies and things like that.
Yeah.
And I would say the only thing that I didn't love was I was obsessed with the term or calling the look of the film new sci-fi. I mean, I don't know. I see kind of Denny's career a little bit different and building blocks moving into one another.
Sure.
But I think the proof is shown in that praise of the sci-fi look and how strong the visual identities of these films are. I mean, I feel like you could really pigeonhole the look of the desert and some of the house stuff and say, oh, it's like kings and queens or dukes and barons in space. The look of what Denny is able to accomplish in this first one is just such a good precursor going into the second one.
Okay, so. Excellent. Yeah, I think it's great to go back and watch it.
Yeah.
It is on HBO Max. Mm-hmm. I think I even bought it on Amazon, too. I think it's a good thing to own, especially because, as we'll get into it, 2 picks up right away. You know what I mean? And it's just nice to have that boom. You know right where you are.
Exactly.
Basically.
Even though I would say for viewers that haven't seen the first one, it's also, I mean, definitely encouraged to watch the first one, but there was an opening narration from Florence Pugh in the second one that kind of gets the broad strokes. You know what I mean? You're not starving on it. I think where you lose out are the political movements of the houses and the manipulation of this universe.
Well,
so.
I know one thing we're going to disagree on already, but before we get to Dune Part 2 and our new release film, folks, we're just going to take a quick reminder to remind you all that we are completely producer-supported here at The Daily Ratings. So Vin and I, whether it's the podcast or the website, we're not going to have advertising. We're not going to shove ads in your face here, take commercial breaks. We're not going to have pop-up ads on the site. We're not going to have paywalls either, where you have to pay to get access to more things, or tier structures where, you know, get $5, you get this, get $50, you get even more. We're not doing that. We're not doing subscriptions either. Basically, it's a value-for-value model we're going on. So you go to thedailyratings.com and you go to the donations tab, and through your donations, through your monetary support, you become a producer of The Daily Ratings, and that's also kind of how we keep this thing going. You know, as more people listen, I think more people are going to kind of catch on to the idea, and it's as we grow, this will grow as well. This producer segment will grow. Because the whole idea right here is not just to pitch the value for value model. It's really to give thanks to those producers who have donated into the show. When you donate, you can go ahead and write a producer note in, and it could be questions, comments, critiques, kind of be an ask me anything question, us anything.
Yeah.
Basically, whatever is on your mind, you know, if you're going to donate to the show, we want to give you a little bit of props or a little bit of, you know, say hi, say thanks, and we're going to read your note right here in the air. We're going to address it. If you don't want your name to be used, you can just write, hey, keep me anonymous, and we'll just call you anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of how we're doing things. It's a value for value model. The idea is, are you getting value from the podcasts, from the website? Is that value in your pocket? Send some value back our way. Again, it's through donations at thedailyratings.com and head to the donations tab. You can become a producer. There's set amounts, or just pick whatever amount you want. Nothing is set. You know, if $5 is a lot to you this week, then that's great. If $50 is a little bit amount of money to you this week, then send $50 our way. It could be whatever silly amount that you want that means something to you, and it opens a through line to you. You write in a note to us, and it just opens up dialogue. It's awesome. We want to hear from you. We want to hear your ideas or just your random-ass questions. It doesn't matter.
And even when it goes to, we do director studies, kind of almost a book club format. In the past, we've loved hearing about your own watching, own recommendations, things like that. So absolutely, we want to hear from you in a very genuine way as the product of what we're putting out there is about, again, kind of journeying through cinema and finding new things and finding how to talk about all these movies.
Yeah. And now that we're out of Dumpuary, folks, you know, 2024 is looking to be a pretty good year. We expect to get some great growth this year, too. Get the word out there. Keep on spreading the word. It's great seeing people continue to come back, but newcomers as well, and clearly enjoying the show. It's awesome to see. So if you could, just keep us in the conversation. It's where we want to be. We appreciate you all so much. And don't forget, it's dailyratings.com. Head to the donations tab. Okay, with that, Finn, I mean, it's a big week. We're both very excited. This is Dune 2. So the whole team is back and many more. We have familiar faces. We have new faces.
That's
as far as actors go, we have, as Josh Brolin put it, we have the newbies. We kind of have the old guard. We have the old school people in. And then you have the people that we've known at least for a little while.
Yeah, yeah.
It's funny looking at this film. We always are talking about who's like the actors under 35 that we're excited for. Where are they?
Yeah.
They're in this film.
Right, right. These are the hot shots.
Almost all of them are in the film.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we're back, and everyone knows the film was supposed to come out in November, was stalled to now March 1st. It's exploded. Had a great first weekend.
Mm.
I don't know how you want to start it exactly.
I'll start it.
Oh, okay. The film was $190 million to make. Which is almost cheap if you think about
some of the superhero ones. Oh my God.
Argyle was said to be $200 million.
Oh my God.
So you have things like that. But
I think a single frame of this movie is better than the entirety of Argyle.
It's very cool. Denis is back, of course. The whole team is back. And as far as shooting goes, I couldn't even figure out how long it took to shoot the film.
Mm.
But they did cool things. Like, they spent 5 days in Dune 1 in the desert, filming in the desert.
Okay.
They went from 5 days to now 20 days this time, or 29 days. A full month they spent in the desert. And Denis wanted to go further in the desert. He wanted no the same locations. Everything
love
that. To be fresh. There's a massive, massive team, hundreds of people.
Mm.
Dune Part 2. Vincent Daly, how did you like it?
Well, it's no secret. I really like this movie. ladies and gentlemen, I have to... Well, I've said it many times before on the podcast. The best sci-fi director of the 2010s is back. And in my opinion, one of the best directors, period. Denis Villeneuve. Sorry, that was a bad joke. Denis Villeneuve. That actually came from listening back to my my old review and us even messing up the
just
name back then.
Butchering
and still was a fan of Villeneuve back then. So.
It's a tough name.
Yeah. Folks, a passing glance at his filmography will show you a director that simply does not miss. Incendies, Prisoners, Sicario, Arrival, Blade Runner. For me, the connective tissue between these films is an approach to gravity in their tone. Not to say that there isn't comedy or light moments existing in across these movies, but Denis' films respect the story as paramount moments for our characters, and through that, respects the audience's time watching it. I feel like, honestly, my love of his directing in some ways gave birth to, you know, is it worth your time? Because I feel like his movies respect your time. And let me tell you, that's a damn good quality to have in adapting something so dense and previously such a failure as Dune on the screen. I would say right off the bat, I think the marketing for this has been very, very smart. Putting our four young stars as the center focus. This, of course, is Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya returning to the series, and now Florence Pugh and Austin Butler in addition. I think my praise here is that this kind of young, this four square of young talent is really strategically smart and grabs your attention and grabs the attention of many different audiences who undoubtedly are new to Dune's story.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the historical success of Dune 2021, but even watching the film, I don't know if it's the hook that would really grab the success that these four stars, putting them on the press circuit, putting them in front of audiences that recognize them, that like them, that love them, and that's going to be drawing that into now Dune Part 2. I really think that's brilliant. In addition to the fun marketing around, like you said, Josh Brolin, Rebecca Ferguson's been doing a lot of rounds, but
yeah,
this
Josh Brolin and Javier.
Yeah.
It's interesting. They are playing the kids a lot. The kids are out there big time. I think you need a little bit of the Josh Brolin.
Mm.
I think you need some Josh Brolin and Javier in there.
Sure.
The kids get annoying.
Mm, okay.
One thing I found is I'm shocked with how much I just feel like celebrity doesn't mean anything like it used to. Even 10, certainly 20 years ago.
Sure.
All you
wanted
to do was be them almost or something like that.
Yeah.
Always see all the interviews and stuff.
Yeah. The nightly circuit.
As soon as I got home from the viewing of Dune Part 2,
uh-huh,
I turned on Rebel Moon part 1 and
wow,
immediately started doing YouTube research and like watching the interviews, trying to do some lore building and stuff,
right,
watch other people's reviews.
Mainly ignoring Rebel Moon.
Right. Exactly right. But I needed something dumb. I needed something that could like I could understand how it was made almost, you know how unimpressive that was. But I just like the four. I'm not the most impressed by the four.
Okay, fair.
I agree that they are tapping into an audience, and they
it is a new audience,
a tidal wave of up and comer.
Yes.
And that's them, and then that's all the people they're attracting for
exactly,
sure, and ticket
people,
buyers,
right? Ticket buyers that would never be even passing, if anything, adverse to watching Dune for how weird and sci-fi it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's the girlies wanting and supporting Zendaya, or it's the it's probably the entire female demographic coming for Austin Butler and Timothy, that would never be caught dead in Dune in the first place. So I just feel like that marketing was, I don't know, I feel like it needs some praise. And where I tie that into the movie itself is, I think this is brilliant because for this section of Dune's story, it's a much better gateway drug for new viewers. The heavy political intrigue of the first film has been usefully simplified to a rebellion versus empire structure, a la Star Wars, or many blockbuster stories that people are more comfortable with. And, don't get me wrong. Don't let me oversimplify this movie. This has plenty of intellect of the last movie, maybe even more when it comes to galactic schemes. But on the surface lies a conflict that is much more straightforward, much more digestible, and much more satisfying for average audiences. And that's why I feel like this match of marketing and what this section of the story was, that was dynamite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a great point. I love that you started there.
Yeah.
And there's something to say about this film too, how consumable it is also is because there's times I look at this where this is just a fantasy Western.
Yeah, sure.
We are so heavy on Arrakis, on one planet, the sand planet, that it doesn't often feel sci-fi. And of course it is, and the world of Dune is sci-fi.
Sure.
It's very easy to just get and obtain in your head, kind of.
It's the recognition thing I was talking about in Dune 84. You need to kind of create ties to what's recognizable.
Yeah.
I feel like, in addition to Western, 100% agree, also kind of a Western fantasy. Lords, ladies, dukes, barons, this is a Shakespearean kind of structure as well to it.
I really was seeing it as fantasy a lot.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah.
Really, part one and part two together.
The abundance of swords, in a sci-fi.
Oh, yeah.
Like that does, the visual language is digestible.
Yeah.
So, the last kind of production note, well, not the last production note. walk that back. I would just say, less kind of like as far as the reception of this film, I would say can we really give some credit to Denny for just killing this PG-13 rating?
Oh.
You know, I mean, I think in addition to this draw of young talent, new viewers, good gateway drug for the universe of Dune is all in this PG-13 rating. And it's coming from someone that says always make it rated
R. I know. And I'll tell you what, it's a note that I have as well. I don't think there is a much better PG-13 film. Mm. I don't think you could make a better Dune PG-13 film almost.
Right, right. You know, especially because it doesn't really hold some punches. You know, there's some blood and there's some intimate violence, you know?
It's pretty wild when you think about, I mean, honestly, I think this and The Dark Knight might be the best PG-13 films.
Absolutely.
That we've got since ratings have become normalized a bit.
Sure,
you know what
sure.
I mean?
Yeah, back and, then, you can't really judge them one-to-one.
Right, but I'll tell you, it is a great PG-13 film.
Yeah.
He utilizes it fully.
Yeah.
You know, no, it's fantastic. Truly fantastic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So all the mainstream success, believe me, I'm the first one to like artsy stuff. I'm the first one to like the cult hit. This is deserved of mainstream success. And I feel like they understand the product as that as well.
Yeah.
Taking the artistic integrity of this aside, I feel like they've done a wonderful job to introduce new viewers to Dune. And I'm here to say that it's a great jumping in point, even if you don't feel like watching in the first one.
I very much disagree. I thought, okay. I honestly didn't think that we were going to be different on this at all.
Sure, sure.
I would so seriously recommend personally watching the first one first. The reason why is I was going to bring up Florence Pugh does have a little bit of an
opening catch up.
Right, opening exposition?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Basically a dialogue monologue. I got to be honest with you, after hearing it, I think people, if you didn't watch the first one, you might be even more confused.
Oh, really? Okay, okay.
I don't think it's understood enough.
Interesting.
I don't know. I think if they did any more and made it way too obvious, I don't think it would be good and be, I don't know, it wouldn't work into the writing too well.
Sure, sure.
But I think if you did come into it with new eyes, I think it would be a little slightly lost.
Sure, sure.
Sure, you can still watch two. Like, it's a good movie.
Yeah.
But to really get the beats down, to understand where these characters are coming from, the emotion behind them.
Yes.
See one first.
Yeah, and I think the silver lining in between is that it's obviously a saga. You know what I mean? This is intended to be watched together.
Massively. So,
well, as far as the story of Dune Part 2, it continues to show us Paul Atreides fighting destiny. Even though it is a destiny told in the tale spun by shadows, coaxed into existence through manipulation on the galactic scale. Now stranded on the hostile desert planet of Arrakis, Paul and his mother Jessica must slowly transform to survive, affected equally by the Fremen society and the all-powerful resource Spice. Despite in the last film Duke Leto urging to Paul that all he ever needed to be was his son, the burden of greatness and revenge weighs heavy on his shoulders, all of this occurring while the machinations of a galactic empire tick forward towards war on the greatest strategic resource known to man, the planet itself, Dune. Folks, if the first film had to do the heavy lifting with Harkonnen and Atreides world building, the houses in this universe, this film is responsible for growing our knowledge of Arrakis itself. A lot of this falls on the romance of discovery between Paul and Chani, Timothy and Zendaya, respectively. I just love what is done here with the world building. I love the water economy required of the Fremen people. It feels genuinely alien and a little gross. I feel like we're exposed to the grossness that maybe Lynch went way into the deep end with, but it's still like important to the text. And, you know, it also makes for a supporting point for other sci-fi reviews of mine. When I complain about language work in science fiction stories, let this movie be the benchmark for the logic I expect from this. At many points watching this, I just felt the sting of lost potential in James Cameron's Avatar universe. Picking the scab of what alien languages can do to add to drama, no less to the simple aspect of who understands what in a scene. Mm-hmm. I feel like with this universe always being so political, always scheming and plots, it was so such a simple approach to, yeah, maybe not everyone in the room understands the English that Paul speaks, or when he speaks, you know, the language of the Fremen and whatnot.
Yeah, and they actually invented a language.
That's great.
For the film.
Well, I don't know, big fans of that.
Yeah, they worked with, yeah, linguistics and stuff, and Denny was very involved as well,
mm-hmm.
But they formed a Fremen language.
Yeah.
And then the main actors like basically went to Fremen school.
Yeah, yeah.
And apparently Javier Bardem like was really good with it.
Of course,
Denny was
he
like
is.
He could practically improv. he was so good.
Oh, I think he's doing some improv anyway.
But it really comes through on screen, and yeah. Not just that, but even just the use of sign language, the use of both of these films start with an ominous message, kind
yeah.
of with the most craziest language going
before
on.
Even the WB logo.
Yeah, I know.
It's like what?
So the use of language is, you're so right too. I didn't know exactly where you're going with that, but so right with the use
yeah.
of language. The Fremen is so prevalent,
right?
But man, when you bring it back and tie it to like an Avatar,
yeah.
and how much it can damage a property and then
right.
lift the other one up. It's awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not dumb. It's not stupid.
Right, right. Well, I feel like that it's an important building block of sci-fi, but not only that, you got skin in the game to do it. Maybe you don't need to make a whole language, but you can use this to create inner drama within scenes of who understands what and
big time, and
character dynamics, and I feel like that is done here to the nines. Like, it's just done so well. Folks, there is a lot to love about Denny's filmmaking here. I say so as a very big fan, but I feel like highlighting some of it is, it shows why Denny is the one adapting this and has the passion to. You hear this in interviews with him, but
yeah.
in the film itself, it really is just a great outcome of where his career has been leading. I absolutely love the simple approach to the passage of time shown in the story. Everything from the progression of war to the growing cult around Paul, and most of all, the subtle changes in our characters. My favorite being the progression of tribal markings on Rebecca Ferguson's face.
Mm-hmm.
As she travels more and more into Fremen society, you see she's becoming more and more ritualistic. What starts with a little bit of words on her face, now, you know, by the end of the film, she's decked to, you know, it's like, you're not going to get a job. No, it's a dumb joke.
No, I like
that. But yeah, I like that. That is the progression to passing time in the story, which it does kind of move in a natural way, or more so in an unannounced way. We're not getting time stamps on screen for
yeah.
you know, this many months later, yada yada.
I think that viewers could get lost a little bit.
Sure.
Where are we? How long is this taking exactly?
Sure.
Maybe that could be a good thing. I didn't know where to put this in the review, but I guess I'll say it now too.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems like virtually so many people are loving this film.
Yeah.
I've heard one guy, and he has like less followers than us, hate this film.
I love that you're doing boots on the ground research when it comes to that.
He was, but a big fan of the books. And so I think from the get-go, I'll say, if you were a fan of the books, this is taking place in the matter of months, not years.
Yes, right.
And I think maybe some, I'll say some fundamentalists of the books might hate that, but that's what we're dealing with. And I think people
yeah.
might get confused a little bit. I think another bellwether as well. I'm trying to just figure out, where are we? How long is this taking?
Yep.
I really can't follow along because it's not obvious.
Mm.
Just the pregnancy of Rebecca Ferguson as
right.
well.
Right, exactly.
I think it also, you can kind of just, one, you know that you're in this, that you're not in this 9-month pregnancy period.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can like see her belly growing
yes.
too as the scenes go by.
Exactly.
So it's these little marks, these mm-hmm. little bellwethers that you can see and kind of tether us to something. Because
exactly.
at times, it's a little bit, the movie does jump here or there
mm-hmm.
To the point where this film could easily be 3 hours and 20 minutes.
Oh, yes.
Like, easily.
Absolutely.
It has a feeling that things, you can almost feel it sometimes when things might have been left on the cutting room floor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
You almost can feel the scenes that are missing out.
Yeah.
But regardless, there are those small things that you can kind of see and understand mm-hmm. where we are time-wise.
And that's what I loved so much about Denny's filmmaking here, is that we didn't get a overt timestamp on
hold
screen.
Your hand.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You really have to pay attention to the movements of the characters. And I feel like that's useful to tune into where our characters are progressing, whether that's morally, whether what the war has done to them.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I feel like that is, it's important to tune in that way. So I absolutely adore the practical lighting effects we see in works like Arrival and Blade Runner 2049, and how they have grown to define the style of the Dune universe. You can see it in the brutalism and the minimalism of Denny's, what he kind of experimented in with parts of Blade Runner. I think a good example of this are the Jared Leto scenes in the Blade Runner film that they feel distinctly alien. There's also some ties into other Ridley Scott properties in that movie as well, or in those moments. But just how they take a very smooth, very minimal set and just some interesting lighting effects make it feel sci-fi. And here that has really defined the look of the whole world of Dune.
Yeah, I think it's a good time to really give a shout out as well to cinematographer as well.
Yeah.
I don't know how many notes you had on him.
I really don't.
Okay, I went hard on notes for Hans Zimmer and Greg Fraser, the cinematographer.
Love it.
Greg Fraser, he's done Zero Dark Thirty, Foxcatcher.
No. It's Sunday, John. It's family day.
He also does Mandalorian, Rogue One, and The Creator, which you really like the look of The Creator.
Right, right. So he's responsible for using those cheaper cameras, but still being really effective.
Though. Yeah, not cheap cameras.
Oh, right.
Not that cheap, but
yeah.
I want to give a lot of praise to Denny.
Yeah.
But man, when I think 5 years from now, if I think back at this film,
mm-hmm.
I will also think about Greg Fraser and probably a little bit of Hans Zimmer and the sound department along with Denny.
Yep.
I think the film is so massive that what is so impressive, if Denny was able to clearly and artistically and audibly let people know what his vision was, he managed to get the perfect individuals that it could actually make that come true. Mm. The look, feel, and vibe of this film, the coloring is incredible.
Yeah.
And I think so much of that really goes to Greg Fraser.
Yeah.
You know, Denny has a vision, wants to implement it, and I think him working with him and Fraser working together made one of the best looking films ever. Whether it be from very dark scenes to very, very bright and white scenes to orange scenes to infrared scenes.
Yep.
It truly a visual feast, a visual spectacle, cinematic experience completely.
Yep. And it's something sorry.
No, just all props to Fraser as well on top of that. I cannot wait to see more Craig Fraser. I think he absolutely is going to be the next Roger Deakins.
And I love that.
Yeah, I'd say confidently.
Yeah,
I'll put money down on it. Yeah,
it's also important team members is something that Jodorowsky comments on in the documentary that he calls it. He needed his spirit warriors.
Right.
So let's just put that aside. But you know, I think it's important that, you know, Denny, as a fan of the Dune books and this being a dream project for him, he is only as strong as his backing team.
Yeah.
I think that's a great shout out, especially with Zimmer. I mean, I don't really have a lot of notes on Zimmer just because it was so, like, it's a great soundtrack, even listening back to it. I don't know why I didn't have notes for Zimmer. It's more so just kind of not same old, but I expected great and I got great, you know?
Very true. Very true. And I would say that his score and the whole soundtrack, they work really, really well on screen.
Mm.
It fits the environment extremely well. I would say, but as pieces along themselves, actually going back and listening, it's good.
Yeah.
It's great. It's Hans Zimmer.
Right.
He's an electric. He loves his electric guitar, especially in his younger career. He's bringing that back. It's very good.
Yeah.
But if I go ahead and say, hey, what's that Dune theme? Oh, I got the Dune theme stuck in my head. You and I might know it right now.
Sure.
Because we watched it twice in the matter of 3 days and are talking about it right away. So honestly, great job, Hans Zimmer. It works super, super well in the theme, and it helps the cinematic experience. I have to say what I'm most impressed with, probably after cinematography and some of the practical or special effects, is just the sound of the film.
Oh, right.
So the
sound,
sound design,
oh my God.
It was shocking.
Yeah.
Shockingly good.
Yeah.
And I'll say it now. Go see it in the nicest, loudest theater close to you. If a Dolby Cinema... Go see it. I saw it in Dolby twice.
Yes, yes.
I was going to go see it in IMAX a second time, but then I didn't want to wait an extra hour.
Yeah, yeah.
The Dolby Cinema was phenomenal. Just
absolutely.
Feeling the bass. Go see it in your IMAX, whether it's the fake IMAX or if you're lucky enough to have a true 70mm IMAX in a major city by you. It deserves and will reward you for spending a little bit extra on a movie ticket for a theater that has better sound.
I would 100% agree. I mean, there's been a lot of push just because Denny is kind of partnering with Nolan on really pushing IMAX projects and whatnot. I feel like the sound was even more important than the visuals. And usually if you're going to get a premium theater like that, having Dolby Audio, it's going to have a good screen already.
Exactly. And it's shocking how well those two paired together.
Yeah.
It just helped with the cinematic experience that you had in the theater.
Yes.
The sound design was epic. You know, as good as Hans was, I think the sound design was even more impressive almost. So that's where I wanted to take a mark to, you know, Hans Zimmer, yes, sound department, and Greg Frazier as cinematographer are doing not heavy lifting, but making things come true for Denny.
I think that's a great way to put it, come true, absolutely.
Sorry, long tangent.
I think that's great because, again, I really didn't have notes in these departments or in these kind of topics just because there was kind of an expectation of it being great and it filled it. So when it comes to what I was so in love with this film, I feel like the absolute best part about this is giving Denny the time and the breathing room to tell this story. And through that, it's able to achieve the real heart of what Dune is about. It's about a balancing act between belief and doubt, something that Zendaya's character, Chani, demonstrates wonderfully in showing that we go from something that she can kind of exist in both, but now has to choose a side between belief and doubt. It exists between the vicious political reign over Arrakis across generations, combined with the menace and the manipulation of the Bene Gesserit. The subtle question the film tackles is if prophecy brings about fate, or is fate controlled by the prophecies we make? It is what author Frank Herbert made the books about in the first place, to warn of leaders and how they attain power through schemes. And wow, do they sell it here. And let me tell you, do they sell this idea through the Bene Gesserit being the psychic, evil, political witches they are meant to be? As many of you know, I love evil shit. I want the bad guys to win. Give me everything. This gave me everything I ever wanted. The Bene Gesserit are basically the combination of the religion of the universe of Dune, but also the shadowy political Illuminati to things.
Yeah.
So as they have a role in these schemes, in the manipulation that is so great about the political sphere of what Dune is about, let me tell you, they fill and they are depicted as such an evil, psychic witches. I loved it so much.
From design, it's fantastic.
So awesome. So awesome. This is 100% my favorite role of Rebecca Ferguson. She is able to ham it up here, which, you know, this might be a little bit of high praise, maybe low praise, depending on where you land with it. But I was thinking of Ian McDiarmid's classic role as Emperor Palpatine a little bit here on where the hamminess was going to come into play.
Oh, whoa. All right. I would say pull it back a little bit, maybe.
Yeah. Better than maybe, you know, what we see in episode 3 of Star Wars.
Right. She does ham it up a bit. I'm right there with you on Rebecca Ferguson, though. She is so good.
Right.
And I think she's really starting to be, in my mind, just one of the top actresses we have today.
Yeah.
What's crazy is she seems like she's just kind of new on the scene, but she's older than Scarlett Johansson.
Oh, right.
You know what I mean? But, boy, she's really come to life, especially post or after being in the Mission Impossible.
You read my mind. I feel like, you know, the work, if you will, she put in the Mission Impossible is now paying off into projects that are really exciting for her.
And just give her more. Give her more. She can handle it. She's great at the role. Absolutely. She hams it up more than in the first film.
Yes.
But in a good way.
Absolutely a good way. It's so awesome. It's so evil. Oh, my God. I just loved the Bene Gesserit in this. I think a good standout is the early ritual scene is such a foreboding and scary sequence. Once again, PG-13, still scary. It sets the tone of what is to come flawlessly. And in addition to kind of the faction of the many factions in Dune, the Bene Gesserit also has our girl, Lea Seydoux, killing it as well. Her scene adding to the scope of the control the Bene Gesserit have. And talk about being part of one of the greatest sequences in the entire film. I mean,
Lea Seydoux?
Yeah. One of the greatest.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. Yes. Yeah, I agree, too. You're picking the good ones here. Lea Seydoux, again, really enjoying her so much. I loved her as the main Bond girl.
Mm.
And then I thought she was great. You stick her in anywhere, and she seems to be doing really well.
Yeah.
She was great in, not Hotel Budapest. She was The French Connection.
Not French.
The
French Dispatch.
She wasn't even born yet. I don't know when the French Connection came out. Yeah, French Dispatch.
Which was actually on the Dune episode.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
funny. But Lea Seydoux, you stick her in there, she's going to do a great job.
Yes.
And I hope to see more of her as well in films, whatever, in Dune Universe. Loved it.
So
and
good.
Also, Charlotte Rampling. I don't know if that was next. Again, the main elder statesman, stateswoman of the Bene Gesserit.
Mm-hmm.
Consistently good and
amazing.
Evil.
Yeah. I believe and that's the same casting in the first one, right?
Oh, correct. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, absolutely fantastic. I would say, why don't we stick on performances? We'll circle back to that four square of talent, or at least the young talent here.
I have notes for everyone. Take
oh,
it where
wow,
you want.
Oh, wow. Really? Okay.
Pages, man.
I would say for Timothée Chalamet, I would say he's really come into the zone here, especially when a critique of mine... and a repeat critique, honestly, in the movies we covered with him, is that he's lacking that iconic role.
Right.
I feel like, I don't know, there's a magic that's been hit here that by the end, you believe it. You know what I mean? I feel like in the first film, apples to apples, I don't know if I would believe it, but there's a progression here that it really takes place in the role and his acting.
Yeah, and in the first one, too, I feel like I'm buying it for some of the film as well because he is really playing the kid.
Mm, true. Naive. And
right, Oscar Isaac, you know, his dad, mm-hmm. the Duke. But I think my biggest thing, he looks like he's 90 pounds soaking wet. And Zendaya looks like she's 60 pounds soaking wet.
yeah, very thin.
I found that these two to be very believable in their romance and their love in the film. Mm-hmm. It comes across genuine and it's really good.
Yeah, yeah.
But kind of like teenagers.
Sure.
Not like strong warriors and leaders that they are. Because Zendaya herself, her own character, Chani, is like a very good warrior.
Yeah,
and has
her
own like political standing a little bit in the tribe or in the Fremen.
Yeah.
So it is tough to get there.
Sure.
You're right, but by the end, you are buying Timothy.
Sure.
Timmy definitely comes into his own, but a lot of heavy lifting in the film needs to happen to make that viable.
Right. There needs to actually – the progression that happens over this subtle time movement is key to what's happening with the character and also in his performance.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's towards the end, I think you're buying it.
Yeah.
Zendaya, I really do like her more than I thought I was going to in these films.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I would just say it's just hard for me to buy the very good, talented, tough warrior that they want her to be.
Because of the frame. And I see.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think my only argument there would be maybe these are guerrilla tactics. You know, these are sand assassins. You know what I mean?
For sure, yeah.
So there's maybe something to the kind of the stealth immersion of that. But I totally get what you mean, you know. Especially when compared to Javier, who doesn't look like Super Jack, but clearly
we'll get into Javier. did I cut off your Timmy, by the way?
No. Well, okay. The only other thing I'll say with Timmy is, I feel like in the early portions where I like the performance as well is he's really able to strike a respectful and scholarly attitude to learning the ways of the Fremen. I feel like it's a perfect match for Dune 2021 where he's just reading books for like 20 minutes of the whole film.
Right, right.
And watching, you know, videos on the Fremen. And I would say in the process of being so genuine in his approach, he charms the audience as well. I feel like I was successfully charmed by Paul Atreides being a transplant in this society.
Yeah, he does sell Paul Atreides. You see him as Paul.
Yeah,
yeah, big time.
Absolutely, Zendaya. I mean, in addition to what you say or what you said, I would say I actually wanted more screen time from her. She was able to embody being our moral and emotional center for the story, which I think is critical towards pointing at the movements in the story and characters of when we slip into a little bit of the bad. I feel like if anything, we maybe needed more characters like Chani to point and say, I don't know if this is the right path we're going down. You know what I mean? I don't know if this is the right vision. So I just enjoyed her character, especially towards the end of when she has to draw the line, and pun intended, the sand,
right.
Where she stands on certain things and the movements of the war.
Yeah. That's a good point, too. And I kind of also feel that this film is also basically two very large sections with a very small third, a very small second act.
Yeah.
And it's where things change. Maybe we get into Timmy or this or story. Things pick up in a different way. And I'm finding that I wish that I'm coming across wishing it was a little bit longer.
Mm.
So things were fleshed out a little bit more.
Okay.
And some of these were relationships. I wish that Brolin and Timmy, they had maybe an extra scene or two together.
Mm.
And I actually wish there was more in the earlier stages of Zendaya and Timmy as well.
Believe it or not.
Or some more of that middle section.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, I think Zendaya, pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. If anything, you know, again, craving more time. You know, I think we're right on the money with that. Florence Pugh, I would say great as a narrator from afar. She has some of the slickest costume work in this whole movie, probably between both the movies, which is saying a lot. I mean, there's a lot of great costume work in that first one, too. That chainmail bodysuit that she's in at the end is just like, oh, my God. It's so awesome. And I would say my only other acting note is, good Lord, what can I say about Elvis? I mean, boy, oh, boy, what shaving someone's eyebrows will do to make them a monster. I really, like, there was... Coming home from the rewatch last night, I looked in the mirror. I was just like, if I shaved my eyebrows, would I look that crazy too? Like,
he would look crazy. Apparently, he didn't shave, so he was filming the bike riders during all this. Uh-huh. So it's a bald cap from his head to his eyebrows.
Oh, okay, that explains maybe even a little bit of the puff. Yeah, actually, because he looks swollen.
What did you think of him, though? Were you buying him as Fade?
He is, well, in comparison to the 84, that's Sting's character.
Yes, yep.
So already on the better, because Sting's acting in 84 is just, this is it. Like, it's just, he just smiles and he puts his hand on his hips. Like, but let me tell you, the fact that he is the center of my favorite sequence in the film is where I was sold on it. I mean, do I think maybe some of, I don't know, the vocal work is, sometimes I was just like, you know, but the fact that he is part of what I loved the most about the film, I'm won over. Yeah.
Okay. My Austin Butler, I kind of have this note too of where I feel like his accent is moving around a bit. And sometimes I feel like he's trying to be Christian Bale in Thor and Love and Thunder. And then
wow, good connection.
And sometimes he's trying to do just a direct accent and descendant of Stellan Skarsgård's character.
Yes, right.
And it's moving around a bit. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So he's hammy, but good. I have to say, watching it a second time, I liked him more the second time.
Oh, really?
A little bit more critical the first time.
Interesting.
But I think overall he does a pretty good job of playing the psychopath that he needs to.
Yeah.
I will say it's Florence Pugh we disagree on a bit.
Oh, okay.
Not happy with Florence Pugh.
Really?
I thought she was stiff. She kind of delivers lines like either she's not comfortable or literally that she's new at this or a little bit of soap opera.
Okay. I think that comes with the high galactic angle, you know, of the level of politics that she's at. But I'm with you.
I would like to say that.
Sure.
And it really comes down to a lot of some negative things I have towards these actors. Mm-hmm. I thought acting in the film overall, it wasn't a highlight.
Mm.
It brought it down a little bit, maybe.
Fair.
But some of that I think is due to the writing,
mm-hmm.
where especially dealing with the young guns kind of, it sounds too much like we're in modern day Earth.
Interesting.
It sounds like a bunch of 20-year-olds are talking to each other.
Interesting.
There isn't dialects going on. And that goes for Josh Brolin. That goes for even some terms that are said.
Mm.
I don't even like the word. I don't even like that, like, Timmy says shit at one point.
Oh.
I want things to be a little bit different. I want to be otherworldly because it's supposed to be.
Yeah. And that's definitely the first film. Even going back to our old review, the Shakespearean spin to the dialogue. I feel like the only normal, you know, quote unquote normal person is Duncan Idaho with Jason Momoa.
Oh, yeah, for
we
sure.
both kind of have, you know.
It's complicated.
it's complicated. We'll leave it at that.
But I really would say that, disclaimer to everybody, the film is not perfect.
Mm, sure.
For sure. And for me, a big thing bringing it down is the writing.
Mm.
And so I do have some issues with some of the acting.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that is due because of the writing, and I think it sounds too modern. Timmy and Zendaya are two modern day boy and girl who are 22 years old. Florence Pugh's even some deliveries and the lines that she's given, she's not set up for success. And then the way she delivered them, I want there to be a different dialect. I want her to take a higher power. This is where Lord of the Rings gets it well. Everybody is talking in a certain kind of fantasy talk or old English kind of thing.
Yep.
And even if Frodo doesn't get it sometimes with Elijah Wood, everyone is taking you towards a different place a little bit. There's something in the dialect that helps you buy this fantasy world.
Mm-hmm.
And here I felt modern. It just felt too modern day, too Western language being used.
And
I mean,
like
Josh Brolin comes out of a tent at one point. He goes, "What the hell?" You know, and it's just,
I think that is spot on and
it's
a very
small
valid
things,
critique.
Probably like a dozen things throughout the film.
And if anything, a little bit of the polar opposite aspect of coming off the first one and it being more old-timey, you know, in the cadence of a fantasy. I feel like this one maybe feels like a departure of that in a bad way, that it loses that. I think that's totally valid critique, for sure.
Florence, so not the biggest Pugh fan in this.
Really?
Shockingly. And I was expecting to get greatness.
She's so gorgeous. Well,
as far as, do you have Walk-In and Bardem?
No. I'm going to just rant
a little bit, if that's okay?
Absolutely.
Javier Bardem is 30 to 50 pounds too heavy for this role, and he needed to lose weight. There's at times.
We never see him with the shirt off,
like,
by the way.
Looks like shit sometimes. There's at one point, towards the beginning of the film, he walks out of a cave, and he goes, it's time to pray. Yep. And as he's walking to his mat, I'm going, holy shit, I'm going, Javier kind of looks like shit. I think my note is, he sometimes looks more, he looks closer to John Candy in the first scenes of Cool Runnings than one of the best, strongest leaders of all the Fremen.
Right. Yeah, the war leader of the Fremen.
So I would say just that.
Incredible.
There is some comedy in the film. A lot of it is put on Javier's shoulders.
Yes, yeah.
I don't like it.
Okay.
I don't like a little bit how they take the Fremen into a little bit more comedic sense.
Mm.
But again, I can't blame that on Javier. That's the writing.
Mm. The one thing that I would say, I'm with you, because at first watch, I was like, it was gut reaction. I was like, oh boy, what's happening?
I was nervous.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. We both talked about the first 40 minutes of this film being on edge.
How about first 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, right.
First 10 minutes, like, amazing.
Yeah.
But definitely for most of that first third, like you said.
Yeah. I think where the worthitness is we do get a more, I don't know, an empathetic look at Fremen society. Even in like the gossip among like some of the younger people, did it feel like the foreign alien world that I wanted for every beat of it? No.
Right.
But I feel like it also is important as a stepping stone to making an empathetic force that is the rebellion to the Empire.
True.
You know what I mean?
For sure.
We need some humanity to it.
Again, second time around, I was more okay with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
My thing is the way they're built up in the first one,
mm-hmm.
and then they have, boom, immediately have that cut as soon as we get into the second one, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted more of a ferocity to these epic fighters.
Sure.
That's all.
Absolutely.
And
the physicality of it.
Man, just watching Javier, I'm like, Jesus, Javier, come on. I'm seeing him do press. He looks skinny. Whatever role he's doing now, he lost all this weight. I'm thinking, oh my God.
It was epic.
He's like, whew, what if they make a bigger suit for you for the second one? And then Christopher Walken, I would just say, is underused. He does not have enough dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
When he does talk, he really is just Christopher Walken.
It's tough. I think that's almost why strategically he doesn't talk a lot.
Well, see, I think if he had more of a runway, he could get into a bit of a rhythm.
Sure.
He does have a moment towards the end with the character, and he gets a little bit serious. He gets a little bit in their face a little bit.
Yep.
And there's some realness there. There's some feelings there. Mm-hmm. Everything else, it's like, oh, it's just Christopher Walken.
Yeah. It's Fat Boy Slim video.
So I think he was just underused.
I agree.
But okay, all right, you take it now.
Okay, all right. Well, we are officially we're officially at the point in the review that I just need to freak out over design, over sci-fi design.
Oh, go for it. Yep.
Yeah. I love Paul's spice visions now having a cool ombre fade away. I really enjoyed that being a visual signifier again, especially after watching Dune 84, and it's just like, who's talking? Like, who is talking? We do lose a little bit of the tangled future aspect of the first film, but visually I thought this development was wonderful. The thumbprint helmet of the worm piss monk, I'm just going to leave that right there. The helmet is like two thumbprints into the metal, and it was just so ritualistic and foreign and looking evil, and that just, the whole scene, amazing. I love that design of that monk.
I'm sorry, what are you talking about?
During the worm piss scene, the one that hands the water of life is wearing like a metal helmet.
Wow.
That has like, it's the design is like two thumbprints through the metal. Amazing.
Okay.
Incredible.
I'm sorry, I didn't really pick up on that.
Yeah. No, it's cool.
Too focused on the worm piss.
Right. Yeah, too focused. The entire Harkonnen Spice Harvester raid, that scene was just incredible.
Incredible.
I would say the design of the harvester is so amazing, and you know,
it's like Howl's Moving Castle.
Yes, I was going to say Studio Ghibli. It looks like the insects from Nausicaa. It was amazing. And also, talk about an amazing action sequence. Simple and creative. This is what I'm talking about, where Denny just kills it with associating to the familiar. I would say the threat is so clearly communicated, and the gimmick of the scene being around these shadows moving sells a sci-fi idea without sacrificing the stakes in the action scene itself. Honestly, action all over this film really satisfies versus the slow crawl of the first. I mean, that was another thing in my initial review, the slow burn that I kept on saying. You know, the initial Harkonnen ambush, a great example of just early action right away. We're getting the juice.
Like first scene?
Yeah.
Oh,
Jeff. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it was, what a way to start a film.
So good.
Made me so happy.
So good. We get more time with the incredible design of the ornithopter, getting a chunky war variant to the sleek scout design that we saw previously. And this is where my notes are on sound design. I mean, holy shit, that delicious hum in the sound design of it flying. If there is a single reason to see that once again in a theater with a good sound system, it's for this. I mean, seriously, got to be the best sound design of the year already.
It is fantastic, and I'll pair this with explosions. Mm. Some of the best explosions in movies in a very, very long time.
Yep.
The flames look great. I mean, the explosions just... I think a lot of them are real. I don't think a lot of the explosions are CGI. Some of them are.
Right.
But I think they blew up some stuff or some Bickagers or something like that. The explosions look amazing. And for that, again, the sound, the bass, the sound of sand and how loud that can be.
Yes.
And with sandworms, utterly, utterly impressive.
Right.
And it is like, what were these guys doing in the sound studio?
Yeah.
What tools did they have, and what were they using to make this kind of stuff?
I researched just because I've always been in love with the ornithopter, the helicopter, if you will.
Is it just a helicopter?
It's called the ornithopter.
No, I know, but I mean like the sound.
Oh, no, it's a three-part thing. That's why I researched. It's a cat, a tent rope, like fluttering in the wind, and something else.
That's how they make the sound?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it's this organic kind of approach to it. I mean, and design-wise, I love robots. I love tech. I love mechs. You know, I mean, it's just so good. I'll just say the term family atomic arsenal just did it for me. That's the note. That's it. and lastly, I would say, you know, everyone is talking about it. The Black Sun ceremony and gladiator fight, you know, this was so great. I was almost driven to tears. I wish I was joking. I was like overwhelmed with emotion watching this the first time. I was like, what? In addition to it being such a good sequence that you just need to watch the movie for it. I don't want to describe the sequence too much. I do want to give a quick highlight to, once again, kind of a theme in this review of Denny and team. I can't say that this was Denny directly, but obviously his team was able to take real science behind the look of the scene. The Black Sun, that is the Harkonnen home planet that it orbits around, actually is a real science gas. There's a gas that burns black, and when it burns, it saps color around it. So an entire sun burning whatever element it would be at in its stage of of development was such a match of hard science in this fantasy science world. I was just like, man, in love with it. That combined with Herbert's original vision for Harkonnen society and having maybe an explanation of why they're so attached to the aesthetics of white and black, and they're painting their teeth black.
Right.
Don't get me started on those referees in the Coliseum.
I
spotted
them
right
you.
Away.
I thought about you immediately.
Oh my God.
I knew it.
It's just perfection. It's just absolutely perfection.
I do want to make a note there. Greg Frazier, once again, the cinematographer.
Yeah, yeah.
There's people, and even like reviewers who've got early access to the film and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a black and white film, you know. These are scenes solely shot in infrared light.
Yep.
And Greg Frazier pitched it to Denis. And Denny said, go for it.
Yep.
The thing is, it can't be reverted back to normal film. It can't be reverted back to normal color.
Very interesting.
So that's how we shot, and then you either get it or you don't.
Wow.
And it came through. It just came through beautifully.
Amazing.
The film in total, by the way, Greg Frazier tried. They tested shooting it on film, but it looked too nostalgic looking.
Oh,
is what he said.
Okay.
They then tried shooting it on digital.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked too crisp, you know, maybe even a la The Hobbit, that crispness that can kind of, you lose the realness, you lose
an artificiality,
a grittiness to it. So what they did was they shot on digital 4K and I believe some Dolby cameras and stuff. And then they did filtering and kind of reverted it back to film and then took that digital to actually get to theaters and stuff.
Awesome, awesome.
Very cool, yeah.
Yeah. Because
the look is phenomenal.
Yeah, and it's you're so right. It's so much different in black and white. Not to mention, as characters are indoors, they're in color.
Yeah.
And then as they walk into this black sunlight that saps color from them.
Right.
It's a transition that you see, and I love the establishing shots of that sequence.
Yeah.
That
yep.
It's not just black and white. I thought, honestly, they were just flashbacks when saw it in the trailer, but the fact that it was so much more and described the Harkonnen society through visual storytelling,
yeah.
My God, like perfection, perfection, my God. So yeah, I like this movie. I'm gonna wrap up.
Go for it. I mean, honestly, two things I forgot. John Baptista is very enjoyable to watch.
Okay.
Stellan Skarsgård.
Skarsgård.
Skarsgård playing the main kind of baddie, Vladimir. Phenomenal.
Yes.
One of the coolest characters.
Put him in
and
more.
Truly phenomenal.
Yeah. And compared to the character of Baron Harkonnen in, again, the 84 Dune, where the approach to him is to make him so gross. To the point that he's getting, like, I think it's cat blood infusions, like, in the... What?
Yeah.
You know? and still make a cool character with the weirdness and his oil baths and his floating,
and
like...
And prosthetics. Not CGI.
Yes.
Prosthetics.
Yes, absolutely. Even down to his cyberware.
Yeah.
Like a little cyberpunk.
Exactly right, yep.
Amazing. Amazing. Folks, where I feel this exceeded the previous film is in the payoff of this story. Dune Part 1 was all set up, and while we always say the establishing first film is usually the best for that initial hook, I think we get a real Godfather Part 2 scenario on our hands where the fulfillment of the arc ranks superior to that rising action. If anything, I would argue Denny has reversed this structure, Part 1 being the fall of House Atreides, and Part 2 having that satisfying rise alongside Paul. Before watching this film, I had a whole week planned out. My usual random movies that would either scratch an itch around sci-fi world building with the theme this week, or just an oddball movie off of my list. But this movie defined my week to the point that I wanted to talk about nothing else but Dune.
Yep.
And that's what we lovingly call a big boy alert.
Whoop.
We're going to go ahead and give Dune Part 2 a 91.
Whoa! First one on the podcast. First one on the podcast. Woo! Wow.
It warped the week. I wanted to do nothing but talk about Dune. I want to consume nothing but Dune. I mean, this was really something special.
Big deal. Big boy alert, Vin. And I agree completely. You know, I listen to a lot of podcasts.
Yeah,
comedy ones. I listen to political podcasts. I wanted to listen to nothing else but movie podcasts after watching it.
Same. Usually where I'm curious of like, oh, what's the, you know, because I follow reviewers still. You know, what's this person say? What this one say? And I try to, you know, gate that past when we, you know, when we record.
Yep.
Here, I didn't even have a desire. I was just like, no, I know I mean, what I know.
Exactly. I mean, I watched this film, came home and had to be, I watched this film, came home and then had to mentally and emotionally deal with the fact that I'm 30 and I just don't have the time to get into this world that doesn't exist.
And yet still wanting to.
Right, exactly.
You wanted to bathe. Like Baron Harkonnen, you wanted to bathe in the oil of Dune.
I mean, we each saw it again Monday night.
Yes.
And just because we couldn't wait to get back to the theater.
Absolutely.
I'm going to bring it back down just a little bit again.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
I do have some issues. I already...
And I think they're valid.
Yeah.
I really do.
I did go into the writing, and so I won't harp on that again. But my biggest problem with the film is the writing.
Mm.
It then hurts some of the acting.
Mm-hmm.
And the acting, to me, isn't unbelievable, wonderful.
Right.
It is hit or miss a little bit. It all works.
Mm-hmm.
It's just nothing is like elevating it even more, except for maybe a Stellan Skarsgård or something.
Sure,
you know what I mean?
I think a great check to that is think about any individual performance. Are these like Oscar winning? I don't know. I think it's more in service
Correct.
To characters
exactly
and
right.
story and the grand arc.
And also, just things happen pretty conveniently. Mm-hmm. So I know it's based on a book. I know there's already source material. Mm. But a longer runtime would have at least fleshed out some ideas, fleshed out some scenes. Mm-hmm. And so things might not seem so convenient.
Yeah.
That is one thing
as well.
You
mean towards the end? I feel like time gets kind of crunched towards the end.
And middle as well. There's some parts in the middle, and that's where I'm saying there's some scenes that felt like they were left on the cutting room floor. Mm-hmm. Again, sometimes I feel like our characters are this way. It flips. Switches and now our characters are this way, and that goes for more than one.
Fair.
And so I think just a longer runtime, which is again something we usually never harp on, make it a little bit longer.
Tell you that, and then the PG-13 rating, it was just like this film is changing me.
It is, it is an absolute cinematic masterpiece.
Yep.
And it's expansive, and it should be seen on a big screen with big sound. I don't think this will hold up as well on TV, and in your TV, in your home.
Sure.
Still a phenomenal film, but there's something. Denny made something for the cinema.
Yep.
Something James Cameron, I made a comment to you, James Cameron wishes he could make this.
Yeah, I would say almost even Nolan wishes he could make this.
Denny is certainly up there with some of the best directors ever, I would say. And he's got many decades to go, which is phenomenal. All props to Denny. He helmed an incredible project and built a team of the perfect individuals to make this cinematic experience. When I think of this movie, as I said before, I will also think of Hans Zimmer, Greg Frazier, along with Denny. So I have to say, watching it twice, I mean, now we were so hyped on it. But,
he's like, I'll give it one shoe, one lace.
You know, because I had some issues with the first third, I felt like it was dragging a bit. I was almost nervous in the beginning.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Absolutely.
Along with the writing and or the acting that wasn't superb. This was a bit of a two-shoe, just one lace.
Mm.
But something about that cinematic experience, the sound design, the visual design, the practical effects, and with Hans Zimmer and Greg Frazier and Denis all coming together making this, it is a cinematic experience to the highest standard. And for that, it lifts everything up as well. This is a two-shoe, two lace on our hands.
Laced
here.
Up.
This is, I mean, I can't go any. So this is a big film. This is our longest review by far.
Oh, right. As far as a single movie.
I mean, my God. It's an hour long, just about. This is the first, I don't even know what, this is well over 500 films on the podcast, I think, Vin, and we're yet to get anything in the 90 percentile.
Right.
I don't know if we hit 89.
Yeah. No.
Sweet Smell of Success.
Yeah, Sweet Smell of Success, a few others, I think. Yeah.
Nope, I think Sweet Smell of Success was an 89, and then 91.
Yeah.
For Dune Part 2.
I really enjoyed it so much. And of course, maybe the elephant in the room is what happens for Part 3. I'll save maybe some of my thoughts on that just because of the aspect of spoilers, but know that Denny, for what will be the next iteration of Dune, is going to start dipping into further books than book one.
Yeah.
And at least into also the main line of Herbert's novels, which is that 1-6.
Yes. So, and that's my understanding as well, because it really is no spoilers. Basically, part one and part two were meant to cover the book because it was such a massive book.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a second book called Dune Messiah.
Yeah.
So as you said, Denny apparently is in the very early stages of writing.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't want to talk about it. He had a very beautiful quote as far as how he looks at cinema and when things are done. And, you know, things are fluid. Things are always changing in this early process. Mm-hmm. It killed it, and it's going to continue to kill it box office-wise.
Yep.
So a third installment. He also said he only wants to do three, I believe.
I love that.
And he also said he might want to do a project in between because these two stand on their own.
Right.
If for whatever reason, Denny, a third film never happens, it doesn't need to. These two films stand on their own.
Absolutely. It's two sides of the coin.
Yes. And there's a Bene Gesserit, show coming.
Oh,
which
really?
I believe is on Max, and Denny is somewhat a part of as well.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens in the Dune world. I'll make one last comment for me, saying this is on track to be my favorite fantasy sci-fi, my second favorite property ever. So Lord of the Rings is one, and will probably continue to be other
one.
You
had to get the gem in there.
I have to say this is on par for Star Wars for me. It's only
two films.
If there is a third film and it continues on this track, if I had a pick, I'd throw Star Wars out for Dune. That's where I'm at with this cinematic, for movies. You know what I mean? For movies.
I'm with you in the sense that it's going to depend on quality and the quantity of projects that we get.
Right.
Right now, with the two knocking out of the park,
looks good.
It looks great. As we talked about many times off podcast, Star Wars is a great example of too much exposure to the ideas and...
too much Kathleen Kennedy.
Yeah, sure, just, right? Maybe like, even too much Lucas,
I
you know?
I feel like there's too much failure in that franchise where things continue like this.
Mm, right. Which is
tough
to say.
I'm so happy that we have.
Yeah, yeah. I think maybe to, not that it's doom and gloom, but you look at even Frank Herbert's original six novels, the quality does dip just in the sense that he gets more and more out there with
concepts. Absolutely.
Again, this is a story that takes place in like tens of thousands or at least 10,000 years. So
yeah, it's massive.
You know, I feel like the hurdle of adapting the full story, the full lore, it's going to be a mountain to climb.
I think Warner Brothers can't even think about that right now.
No.
Because if you think about Doom Messiah and where Doom Messiah goes, it's there's something to be said about the ease of having to be really on one planet for two films.
No, absolutely.
You know, there is something to be said there.
Yep.
But do you think that this is the feeling people got when they saw Raiders for the first time? And how explosive that was?
Maybe like a lot of the desert work, certainly.
Well, a big blockbuster, people love that film.
Yeah,
like when Raiders came out, it was such a mark for cinema.
It lived up to the hype when we covered it
And people now, because of Raiders, people just try to make more Indiana Jones. Mm. You know what I mean? The copycats. I wonder if this is almost going to change cinema a little bit. Mm. If you think about desert work, I really was putting thought on this. If you think about desert work in film.
Yeah.
I would say you now have this. You had Raiders, and then maybe you have Lawrence Arabia.
Wow, that's a great list. I don't know. I guess I would have to think of desert work, but yeah, that's as far as a short list.
I mean, Mad Max. I don't think it can hold. Mad Max, great movie.
Oh,
love Fury
Road.
I know Fury Road is great.
That's some good desert.
It's not Dune 2.
No, it is definitely not.
Do you think this will change cinema a little bit as far as mixing your practical and your CGI and spending money CGI where it's important, where it kind of bleeds off the screen? You don't really see the CGI too much.
Yeah, I would like to say optimistically yes, but when looking back at the practical effects work of Denny, the key is in who's making it. The key is in who's helming the ship here. I'm not a huge fan of his movie Enemy with Jake Gyllenhaal, but I watched, you know, again, in the slew of behind-the-scenes stuff that we've both been watching, he described the shot work in Enemy as being done with real spiders green-screened into miniature sets. And it's just like, that's like his like third film. Like, no one's doing it back then. I don't think anyone's going to be doing it now.
I wouldn't quite say that. I mean, that's almost like using bigatures and miniatures.
Sure. But I don't feel like people, or rather directors, are looking to subvert the use of CGI in the way that he is.
Well, I'll tell you what. If it's even a little bit cheap, for $190 million, you got this look.
Maybe the studios will see
that's
that.
That's what I'm saying. There's something to be said, and there is... You can tell when there's bigatures or when there's a mix of real people and bigatures.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that something might not be right. Mm-hmm. It is so much more acceptable than CGI or full-on CGI. This film has it. You're going to be watching stuff that doesn't exactly seem completely real.
Mm-hmm.
There are some shots that aren't seamless. But it's why The Lord of the Rings 20 years later is still good.
Because
it's something that's acceptable, at least, about it.
Right.
All these years
and versus
later.
The Hobbit trilogy.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
That's
right.
The
exactly
eternal
right.
punching bag of the Hobbit trilogy.
Any finishing notes, Vincent Daly?
Oh, no. Just go watch it. just go watch it,
in
folks.
A big theater. Spend the money.
Really
this
good.
Is worth your experience. It's been years since I feel like a movie experience like this visually we've had. I really don't.
And that's where I, like I said, I opened up with, you know, not to eliminate the magic of you know, the podcast, and of course, you know, love you all for listening, but sometimes it is very much a job. Sometimes it's intimidating. Here it was all love.
I was excited
to put the podcast into form and talk about this wonderful, wonderful movie.
Well, now you know how I feel about Kung Fu Panda 4 next week. So people, please do stay tuned, because the Daily Ratings continues with our normal programming next week. You know what's funny is we have this special coming out, No Country for Old Men, reuniting Javier Bardem
and
Josh Brolin.
I started
with saying, you know, we haven't had a 90 percentile this entire time, so we're taking a look. So basically, this is almost a special, and we have another special coming up in 2 weeks as well.
But absolutely.
Listen, we're going to have a bunch of fun next week. I'm going to watch some Kung Fu Pandas as well. It's not going to be as heavy. We have some easy topics. It's going to be a blast. Just four films as well.
The Bene Gesserit are they make the dumplings.
Yeah. Folks, thank you so much for hanging out with us this week. Vin, thank you for watching these films. Coming on by. Folks at home, we'll run it down one more time. We have Dune from 1984 with a 20%. Jodorowsky's Dune with a 70%. Dune from 2021. We ended up giving that, by the way, an 83, mm-hmm. we should just say. And then, of course, our newly released film, Dune Part 2 with Denny, with a massive 91%. If you're new to the podcast, that's a big deal. This is not your Rotten Tomatoes, okay? This is not your Ebert. This is not your IMDb. 91 is a great, great mark here. Very impressive. First film on the podcast that hit the 90s. Love it so much. So, folks, thank you so much for listening this week. We'll see you next week on the Daily Ratings Podcast. Hey, if you enjoyed the podcast, if you would, give us a good rating or get the word out and tell a friend about us. And just a reminder that the Daily Ratings is completely producer-supported. We want to stay away from advertising, and we don't want to have any paywalls or tier structures or subscriptions. It's all just value for value. So, are you finding value in any of the things that we're doing here on the Daily Ratings? Then become a producer and donate whatever amount of value that is. Just go to the donations tab on thedailyratings.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the massive amount of films that Vince has rated for us. So thanks so much, everybody. We'll see you next time on the Daily Ratings Podcast.